It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. My name is Ben Kiefer. My guest today is NPR's science correspondent, Joe Palca. Joe Palca's latest series, Joe's Big Idea, explores the minds and motivations of scientists and inventors. He's also worked as a television science producer, a senior correspondent for Science Magazine, and Washington News editor of Nature. He's coming to Iowa. He'll present a program titled Reporting on Remarkable Science and Remarkable Scientists at 7 p.m. this coming Wednesday at Phillips Hall in Iowa City, an event that's free to the public. It's an appearance that's part of the University of Iowa's Public Policy Center's Fork and Brock series and the Office of Research and Economic Development's Creative Matters series. His visit is also sponsored by Iowa Public Radio. Joe Palca, welcome to our program.
Thanks so much.
Give us a little preview, a little snapshot of what you plan to talk about.
Oh, I couldn't possibly do that. I mean, don't you know the art of the tease? I'm supposed to... Well, okay, a little bit. I'm sure I can talk a little bit. Actually, I'm going to pick out three or maybe four of the stories that I've covered over the last 3 or 4 years of this project that I think really represent what I'm trying to do, which is to talk about science not as a series of results or endpoints, but as a way of getting to an answer. And inevitably, the answer raises more questions, and so that gives you more to look into. But there are going to be three people that, you know, I've worked in radio I'm in my 25th year here at NPR. Oh, my goodness. And these three people are among the most memorable I've ever spoken with, both for who they are and for what they do. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about them and about covering them and about the other kinds of things I cover. And just for a little more information, one happens to be a chemist who made an app to detect eye cancer. And the other is a biochemist who is responsible for one of the most important biological tools to hit medicine or biology in the last 100 years, even, I would say. And the third is a pediatric oncologist who's researching ways to make it easier to do surgery on tumors, brain tumors, without destroying healthy tissue. So they're amazing stories. They're amazing research. And if nobody else has a good time, I'll have a good time because I love these stories. And okay. I had to listen to them again to pull the cuts I'm going to play. And I still like listening to them.
Okay, I won't ask you anything more about that event. No spoilers.
Well,
no spoilers. No. I want you to come out and see Joe Palca Wednesday at 7 p.m. in Iowa City. It's an event that's free to the public. I want to reach out to our listeners this hour. What are your questions for Joe Palca? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Or find Iowa Public Radio on our Facebook page and leave us a question or a comment for Joe. Back to the idea behind Joe's big idea, the process is the focus rather than the result. So broadly speaking, how does that change our picture of science? What do you want to do there?
Well, again, not giving anything away, but I'm going to show a slide tomorrow or Wednesday that is very revealing. And it's basically a bunch of different foods, sugar, deep fat, salt, and, just a variety, wine, red wine, white wine, coffee. And there's a line down the middle of the slide going up and down. And on one side, for each one of these food groups that I just mentioned, there's causes cancer, and then on the other side it says prevents cancer. And there's a dot for each study in the last 5 or 10 years that goes one way or the other. And the slide is hilarious because there are about as many causes cancer and prevents cancer for virtually every particular food group that I just mentioned. And
all right.
So what happens when you cover the results, every one of those results is interesting, potentially important, and tells us something about food and diet and nutrition and health. But the individual studies can be contradicted over time. And so what I think happens a lot of the time in science is that you get to a result, and people like to say, well, here it is. And does that tell you what to do for certain? Well, sometimes, but rarely, most of the time it tells you, well, here's what we know now, and we may know more if we do more research.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that you're going to a place where it may lead to a distrust of science, because one week we hear, oh, chocolate is really good for you, it's really good for the brain, and then the next week, oh, another study that shows it opposite, right? And we say, well, we can't count on science.
I think that does happen. I mean, it's hard for me to tell because I've baked in my appreciation of science and why I think it's important and why I like to talk about it and learn about it and read about it. But I also, you know, I used to be a scientist, and I know what it means to get a result that seems at odds with a former result. Now, sometimes you did, in fact, make a mistake. I mean, there are times when you get a result that's very perplexing. It seems to defy all logic, but you can't figure out what you did wrong, so you publish the paper, and somebody else figures out what you did wrong. I mean, there was a famous example a few years ago of these guys in Italy and Switzerland who thought they had detected a particle, a neutrino, moving faster than the speed of light. And that's not supposed to happen. But they did their equations, and they did this, and they did that, and they did all these things, and they said, look, this doesn't make any sense to us, but the result is that this seems to be moving faster than the speed of light. And so they published it, or at least they announced it to the rest of the scientific community, and lo and behold, somebody figured out where the problem was, and it happened to be a problem in some of the electrical equipment they were using. So if you come out so forcefully, I mean, and it's much easier because, look, we're in the news media, right? The news media doesn't want to do on the one hand, on the other hand, most of the time. They want to say, what just did we learn? You know, what does it mean? What does it mean for my family? Should I stop eating this food or should I not worry about it? And most scientists, if they're honest, will say, well, the best evidence we have at the moment tells us to do this. But, you know, there could be other reasons, and different people have different reactions to different food groups, and it depends on your genes, and it depends on the environment that you live in, and what else you're eating in your diet, and whether you have a flu or some other illness at that time, or whether you have some other condition. So, yeah, I mean, from the news media's point of view, it's like one thing one day and another the other. And if you're not parsing these things carefully, it sounds like, as you say, that scientists are all over the map and not trustworthy. And that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
There is a process of science that uncovers the truth, and sometimes it takes an uncomfortably long time to get to the answer. But they do, I think, a lot more often than they don't.
Your questions for Joe Palca, live this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to our first caller. Brian is in Dubuque. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the program. What question do you have for Joe Palca?
Well, hello. I actually have a question that may come in two parts. One, as a science communicator, what is your biggest hurdle in actually conveying solid science when there's an internet full of misinformation? And what, as just an enthusiast of science, what is a good tool to use to try to combat that? Because I run into that a lot.
Yeah.
Brian,
yeah.
Ooh, two big questions there, yeah.
Well, my best advice is don't look at the internet. Just tune into NPR and listen to me, and you'll get it all right. No, I don't mean to be facetious. I think those are two of the biggest issues that we have right now. The biggest hurdle, I think, is it may have emerged from what we were just talking about, is maybe a growing reluctance to trust scientists, that people think, well, you know, that's all fine and good, but I know what I know. That seems to be an attitude that a lot of people take. Somebody once said that the plural of, or actually I know who said it to me anyway, is a guy named Alan Leshner, but he said the plural of anecdote is not data. But that's a hard concept for people to get into their heads. Anecdotes are very powerful, and that's what people tend to remember. So I think the trick to doing good science journalism is finding the anecdote, the personal story, the sort of the intimate detail of a story that really represents the most accurate portrayal. And that puts a big burden on the journalist, because it's, you know, sometimes you have a great anecdote, fantastic anecdote. It just gives you the wrong, I mean, it's an outlier. It's not accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a problem. I also feel that there's a, you know, we always ask ourselves when we're putting stuff on the air, okay, what do I have to explain? Well, okay, so I don't have to explain blood pressure to somebody. If I say someone has blood pressure, I don't go in and say, now, blood pressure is a measurement of how, you know, how much pressure the blood that's flowing through your veins puts on the, or in the arteries, puts on the walls of your blood vessels, and you don't want it to get too high because it can cause a variety of additional problems. Okay, so I can say blood pressure. But if I say myocardial infarction, ooh, now I'm into jargon and I have to be careful. So we're always trying to figure out, well, what do people know and what do I have to explain? And honestly, I think that a lot of the time you have to explain a lot. And you spend a lot of time, the news in a story or the actual thing you're trying to describe sometimes is the smallest part of your story because you're setting everything up so that people will understand it. And it sometimes takes you a long time to get there. So I would also say that the lack of science literacy or the decline in science literacy that some have measured in this country is also discouraging. I think that makes it our job harder. Mm-hmm. But, and this is the other but, I think I'm of the opinion right now that what has to happen is that anybody who thinks clearly about science, knows about science, likes to communicate science to other people, should start doing it. Don't complain about others who are doing it badly. Start doing it yourself. Because when I started in the business, you had to have a television tower or a radio tower to reach people on broadcast. And you had to have a printing press if you wanted to print a magazine or a newspaper. And now anybody sitting at his or her desk, typing on the computer, recording on their phone, can put together a credible radio story, television story, print story, multimedia story, on their own. And yeah, they won't get a million listeners like sometimes I get on NPR. I get that. But if 1,000 people reach 1,000 people, that's a million there too. So that's my new mantra.
Joe,
I'll say that tomorrow too, probably, or Wednesday.
Joe, let me piggyback on your comment on the lack of science literacy in this country with this question for you from a faculty member at the University of Iowa in Iowa City that you have, I believe, in fact, interviewed probably more than once, Peter Thorne. He's a professor and head of occupational environmental health at the University of Iowa, also director of the Environmental Health Sciences Research Center at the UI. Here's his question for you. That he emailed in, the biomedical research labs at our R1 doctoral universities are staffed primarily by foreign graduate students and postdocs in the U.S. on student visas. What does this mean for the future of innovation and R&D in this country?
They thought the question was heading in a different direction because the new administration has been talking about eliminating or reducing those special
visas. Well, I think
visas.
It is. So, I think it's asked in that context. Yes.
We're engaging in a big experiment, I think, is what it means, and we'll see about what the productivity of biomedical research labs will be or will continue to be given that circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
I
guess he's just worrying about. If we don't have foreign graduate students and postdocs on these student visas, what would we be left with? I mean, do we have the resources among our own people?
This is not a field that I'm expert in, so if anything I say will be just my own perception from wandering around and looking. I know how important the issue is. I'm guessing that the people who select foreign graduates students to fill various positions do so because the people who are hiring them think that's the best person for the job. But it may not be the only person for the job, and there may be graduate students or undergraduates who would be the second choice or the third choice or the fourth choice in some cases, and they would be in line for that job. If there really are no American citizens capable of fulfilling the needs of researchers in this country, then we've created a difficult situation. And I think maybe that goes back to the failure of people to appreciate science and science education. But surely there are enough science majors in this country to be enticed into research to do some of the work. Or, and this is, I mean, I used to be a lab technician in a research lab, and I know a lot of things graduate students do in research labs is the stuff that I used to do when I was a lab technician. And so it's possible that the intellectual capability of the person doing the pipetting and doing the running the centrifuge and things like that won't be as high, but maybe there will be opportunities for people who didn't realize that some of that work is at least not requiring a major amount of education. I won't say intelligence, education.
Mm-hmm. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca with us this hour. Join us, 1-866-780-9100. I feel we've kind of been dancing around the bush, beating around the bush a little bit, because you're coming to the University of Iowa on Wednesday evening to speak in a free public presentation 1 week after a momentous election. Some would say, many would say, I think the most momentous election in living people, the memory of people living today. You used to work for Nature. You were an editor there, news editor. Here's something I'm reading right off the web right now. From Nature.com, the ultimate experiment, how Trump will handle science. What are your questions on that, or answers on that?
Well, I mean, it's funny because during the campaign, I have to say, during most campaigns in the past, somebody at some point has come over to the science desk and say, what are the candidate's views on science, and can you do a story about that? And I have to say that didn't happen this year, and I didn't hear a large groundswell from anybody saying, "Hey, what's the difference here? We've heard Donald Trump say that he thinks that climate change may be a hoax, but we heard Hillary Clinton say, "I think climate change is real, and I'm going to do something about it." So if it's that one question, we at least have some indication about which way the new president is going to take things. But the rest of it, the visa question, the funding question, should we go to, I don't know if you remember, but earlier this year, President Obama announced that he thinks we should be ready to send a human to Mars by the 2030s. Now, a lot of times presidents, including President Obama, say those sorts of things and leave it to future presidents to find the money or future generations to find the money and the willpower. So the president set a lofty goal, but unlike the Kennedy administration, which actually put tons of money into getting to the moon, the Obama administration has not put tons of money into getting humans to Mars. Will the next president feel that's a priority and say, yes, we should do that, and it will create jobs, or it will lead us into a new future, or it will do something? I don't know. It's just not been explored. And honestly, from what I could tell, nobody was making a decision about who to vote for based on what that person's stand was on science writ large. Mm-hmm. It just didn't seem to be one of the bits of information that people were clamoring for.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly very difficult. So many open questions, not just related to science and the new president, but all sectors, almost all sectors, because it didn't have detailed policy statements on a lot of areas. But perhaps this is an easier question to address. How do liberals and conservatives see the support of scientific research differently?
Oh, I was sort of hoping you were going to say, when you said an easier question, you were going to ask for my favorite color.
Sorry, Joe.
That doesn't sound a lot easier. And it sounds, and frankly, it sounds like filled with warning, Joe Palca, don't open your mouth and say anything
politically.
Yes, ding, 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 ding. I have to tell you, in my limited experience, that most universities, taken writ large, taken as a group, tend to swing toward the liberal direction politically. Now, it also turns out to be the fact that liberal people sometimes don't feel science funding This is non-scientist liberals don't feel science funding is as important as conservatives, because liberals think that if you're going to spend federal dollars, you should spend them on programs that help people and not on programs that will increase human knowledge or will help people down the line, some kind of long-term thing. So it can be paradoxical to scientists who tend, I think, to skew liberal, that suddenly the Congress, which might happen to skew conservative, is putting more money into their research, even though they don't agree with them politically.
Mm-hmm.
So I just got off the phone with someone, because I was asking this question, who thinks that, he just said to me, a Republican-controlled Senate is better for research funding than a liberal or a Democratic-controlled Senate. And I don't know who he was referring to in the—I don't know which liberal he was or Democrat he was talking about, and I don't know which conservative, but I'm guessing that the incoming chairman of some important committee had already expressed a position that, you know, we've spent enough on these damn scientists. It's time to help real people. That comes up.
So that's a tendency to get away from basic or fundamental research and go toward applied research.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But never mind about applied or not applied. I'm talking about, you know, programs, job training programs, or more social safety net kinds of programs, rather than medical research that even applied medical research. Because they look, I mean, we don't have to. This is the argument. I mean, the federal government doesn't have to spend its money on developing new drugs. The drug companies can do that. They're making zillions of dollars, you know, and there's a profit motive, so they have reason to pursue this. You know, we can let them take care of the new drugs and new treatments. I'm creating a wholly made-up scenario. I don't say this is the case for a second, but I'm just saying that, you know, the tags of liberal and conservative, Republican and Democrat, don't always completely line up with who's going to be supportive of science and who's not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Joe, hang on. Joe Palco with us from Washington, NPR's science correspondent. He's going to be in Iowa on Wednesday. You can see him, his presentation, Reporting on Remarkable Science and Remarkable Scientists, at 7 o'clock Wednesday in Iowa City at Phillips Hall. It's an event that's open, free to the public. And we're going to continue our conversation with Joe Palco. And when we come back, we'll address more science and probably some politics. Beep, 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 minefield, Joe. When we come back, we'll ask Joe about RAGBRAI, because he's been on RAGBRAI, and evidently that's where he got the idea to come here to visit Iowa this week. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, my guest will be Sarah McCammon, formerly of Iowa Public Radio. She'll join us to talk about press freedom and her experiences covering the Trump campaign for NPR. That's tomorrow on this program. Today on the program, NPR science correspondent Joe Palco. He'll be speaking Wednesday evening in Iowa City at 7 p.m., an event that's free to the public. And we're talking with Joe about a variety of things, his new series, and a variety of things. Of course, a mm-hmm. few politics mixed in, Joe, necessarily, mm-hmm. a week after the election here. I wanted to, before we get back to callers, by the way, join us with your question, 1-866-780-9100. Before we go to callers, Joe, you mentioned climate science. Here's President-elect Donald Trump speaking on the O'Reilly Factor. This is December of 2015, in response to a question about whether he believes in climate change and whether he thinks the world will change for the worse because it's getting warmer.
I think that there'll be little change here. It'll go up. It'll get a little cooler. It'll get a little warmer, like it always has for millions of years. It'll get cooler. It'll get warmer. It's called weather. I do believe in clean. And I've received, a lot of people don't know this, I've received many environmental awards, many, many environmental awards for the work I do. And I believe strongly in clean water and clean air. But I don't believe that what they say, I think it's a big scam for a lot of people to make a lot of money. In the meantime, China is eating our lunch because they don't partake in all of the rules and regulations that we do. They're buying our coal. We're not using our coal. They're buying our coal and they're using it. And then they compete because they're spending a lot less money to build their products and to make their products. So I am a believer in clean air and clean water at the highest level.
Okay, Donald Trump from late 2015. In 2012, he tweeted, "The concept of global warming was created by and for the Chinese in order to make U.S. manufacturing non-competitive." So, Joe, we have the sort of latest in the last few days. Evidently, Donald Trump, now president-elect, seeking ways of withdrawing from a global agreement to limit climate change. The agreement was reached by almost 200 nations in December, and as of a few days ago, it's been formally ratified by over 100 of those countries, representing 76% of greenhouse gas emissions, including the United States, with 18%. So I'm wondering, first of all, what happens now if the U.S. Withdraws from this global agreement? What are your thoughts there on any part of this? There's so many facets.
Yes. Well, I was instructed to, instead of saying, "I don't know," to say, "That's a really interesting question."
Followed by
changing the subject.
That's a political show. That's what happens when I interview politicians,
right.
Joe.
Well, I'm trying. So here's what I think. First of all, it always amazes me. It always amazes me that any politician, and I mean even Al Gore, but I'll say even Al Gore because I know he spent a lot of time on it. On a question of climate change, but unless you've trained, unless you've gone to graduate school or really, you know, educated yourself full time on the intricacies, I mean, understanding the planet's climate is fantastically difficult, and understanding all the factors that influence it. I remember there were climate models for initially that they didn't take into effect clouds because they didn't know how to put them into the models. Okay. That just says, okay, fine, but that, you know, you can't leave out clouds. There's lots of clouds. Look up, you'll see them. And they have an effect on things. Sometimes rain comes out of them. I mean, the point is, the complexity of understanding the climate is enormous. And for any politician who might have read an article or had a briefing or something like that to start acting as if he or she was some sort of expert on the subject it's hard for me to fathom. I don't see how people can post themselves as experts or answer questions as if they were expert with so little knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And just one of the points is that the climate scientists make a big distinction between weather and climate. And weather is something that's happening to you now, and climate is something that's happening over a period of years. So, I mean, there's lots of misunderstandings. Now, when I heard those pieces of tape that you were playing, it said to me, leaving aside the scientific argument for a while, I think something unfair is going on in terms of trade, and it happens to be connected to climate. And so I'm making an argument that we should do something to reconcile an imbalance in trade. And I'm going to minimize the other consequences of that statement because I'm more interested in the trade part of the equation.
Mm.
And maybe he wasn't exactly minimizing, but that's one way of thinking about it, that you can say, look, climate change, even if you say climate change is real, you still have to say, well, what are you going to do about it? How much are you going to conserve? How are you going to change the world's economy to achieve some of the changes in behavior or changes in emissions that scientists say is necessary? So I think there's a very difficult job that policymakers have to make to say, okay, here's the best science that we have that says something is happening. And I'm sorry, I don't think that scientists are scam artists. There may be some in the range of human behavior scientists, or there are some scientists as, who are scam artists, just like there's some politicians and some lawyers and some, whatever. Pick whatever field of human endeavor. There are scam artists in probably all of them. But I don't feel, from having interviewed scientists for 30 years, that they're like, oh, I'll make up something about the climate so that I can extract money from the federal government to study that. That just seems beyond the pale to me. So I don't accept this scam artist explanation, and I don't want it to sound like I'm making a political statement, but I as a science correspondent, I do not accept that explanation. And I don't really feel that repeating it makes it true. Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult question to take scientific knowledge, such as it is, and apply it in the real world. And I think especially with climate, it's just difficult. Now, what's going to happen if Donald Trump has his way and things change the way he describes, and that he does want to bring clean water and clean air? Well, burning a lot more coal is sort of at odds with having cleaner air, at least as far as I know. The clean coal technology hasn't caught up with the amount of particulate matter and other things that coal is capable of putting into the atmosphere. So there's some contradictions there. But we're in, like as you read earlier, the Nature article, we're in the midst of a big experiment.
The ultimate experiment, yeah.
And in 4 years or 8 years, we may say, oh, my God, that was a mistake. Or we may say, we misjudged and it wasn't as bad as we thought it would be. So do not make me read the future. Okay. I will not do that. I am really trying not to get into that world.
Okay. Joe, take me by the hand. We're going to walk out of the minefield here.
Okay, good. Thank you.
NPR's the science correspondent with us, Joe Palca. Let's go to our phones, perhaps out of the minefield. I don't know what Teresa in Stewart has on her mind. Hi, Teresa. What's your question for Joe Palca?
Hi. Well, this is a question involving my six-year-old grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
He is being taught a fundamentalist, creationist point of view in a homeschool environment. And he comes to my house, and he wants to preach to me about how man and dinosaurs coexisted. And I don't want to disrespect his beliefs, but on the other hand, I want to respond to him in a way that will encourage him to look to science to explain the world around us and the things that he is eventually going to choose to believe as an adult.
Well, Grandma Teresa, you're in a bind.
Yeah.
Joe.
Well, that can we go back into the minefield, please? No, I'm just fooling with you. I think it's a fascinating conundrum, because I do understand people of good faith, appropriately enough, who take a position on the age of the Earth, for example, that seems to be at odds with what science is saying. And the only thing I can say is to I've met people, and there's some very famous scientists, including, I don't want to say this because it's a giveaway, but one of the people that I'm going to be speaking about on Wednesday night is a devout Christian, and he is about as fundamentalist as they get, and he's a total scientist. So some people are able to balance in their heads a faith-based argument and a scientific-based argument as if when they get older, because they understand that there are contradictions that are unresolvable if you believe each to be the absolute truth. So what I would say is that rather than talk about the specific conflict between what carbon dating and other things say about the fact that humans and dinosaurs lived on the planet together, I'd go off in a totally different direction and talk about all the other scientific things that there is no conflict about, and hope that as this young man grows up, that he will be able to see these contradictions, because he'll see how so much of science is factual-based and non-faith-based, and will bring that same critical eye to the things he's been taught as a young man. But that's me waving my hands, because I haven't faced that situation in my family. I mean, that even complicates it further. So I'm sympathetic to your plight. But that would be one explanation. I think I would focus on the other bits of science and space or things that don't seem to fly in the face of strongly held religious beliefs.
Okay, Teresa and Stuart, thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Okay, let's go to Roger in Estherville. Roger in Estherville with NPR's science correspondent Joe Palca. Roger.
Thank you. My question is, scientists are sometimes accused as being elitist when legitimate science is actually indifferent to valid observations. What more can we do to convince politicians and lobbyists that scientists are not being elitist but just trying to communicate truth, which can sometimes be complex?
Yeah. That's a great question, too, because I find sometimes that I find scientists to be elitist and dismissive of people who don't follow them, don't know as much as they think they other people should know. So I would say that scientists have a role to play. I think there's a movement now, which I'm very encouraged by, which is younger scientists. These are graduate students and postdocs and maybe junior faculty who feel that the scientific community has done a bad job overall, not in every case, in sharing the joy and delight and accuracy and value of what they're doing. And they've kind of taken the attitude is, well, I don't really have time to explain this to you because I'm very busy and important, and I'm busy learning things that you couldn't possibly understand. And I think that the part of the answer will be when scientists in general come down off their high horses and say, this is a great adventure, and I want you to come with me on it, and I'm going to share as much as I can about it with you. And engender trust in that way, rather than say, listen, I'm doing right, and I am right, and if you don't believe me, there's something wrong with you, and so I'm going to speak loudly and clearly, and that will be enough for you to understand what I'm saying. And sometimes it's just not.
Mm. Let's go to Jacqueline. Thank you, Roger, in Estherville. Jacqueline in Roland. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hey there.
Hey, what's your question? We're running out of time, so I'll ask you to be brief, please.
Sure, I'll be real quick. I work at an institution that deals with helping the public learn about nature and learn about science. And it seems like Joe's work has always been in the area of science communication. And I know that there are some organizations out there, like Alan Alda has gotten involved in helping to promote science communication, and I would like to hear Joe talk a little bit, or give him the opportunity to talk about why science communication is important. And
well, I think it's true. I think, as I said, that I've been sensing and encouraging a great movement to people to become better communicators. I just spoke with Alan. I just actually saw Alan Alda, and it turns out we've known each other for almost 50 years for circumstances which I won't get into now. But I've known him a long time, and I just had an opportunity to talk with him a couple weeks ago. And his philosophy is very much aligned with mine. He is this amazement in science and delight in sharing it. And that's what I'm trying to capture, is more of this delight. I think people become more accessible. What they have to say is more palatable, even if it's something you don't want to hear, if they don't sound aloof or doctrinaire. And that's how I think it's a very valuable thing. I don't want to punish, this is the flip side, I don't want to punish scientists who aren't good communicators. I mean, you can be an outstanding scientist and just be uncomfortable as a communicator. I get it. But I think there's a lot more space for people who are even indifferent or a little bit nervous or any of those things, at least not to be dismissive or ignoring the potential importance of science communication.
About 4 minutes left with Joe Palca. I wanted to get to two more things very briefly, Joe, before we say goodbye for the day. Talking about delight, what is the delight that you are most excited about seeing develop in the next 5 or 10 years in the area of science? What's really going on that excites you?
Well, gee, I was hoping we'd get to Mr. Porkchop on the RAGBRAI, but never mind.
We can do that if you do this quickly.
Okay.
I can talk for hours about Mr. Porkchop.
Okay. I think the new this is where I'm at right now is I think the new telescopes that are coming online that are going to the James Webb Space Telescope that's going to be launched in 2018 and the large synoptic survey telescope which is being built in Chile now, I think they're going to look into the heavens and they're going to see things that could not be anticipated. In the same way that, you know, when you and I were being taught in school, there were 9 planets. And there were no other planets anywhere else that we knew of. Well, now there are only 8 planets, and we can argue about that, of course. But they think there might be a 9th planet, so that's really cool. But there's thousands of planets that have been seen around other star systems.
Right.
And who knows what we're going to see next. So I find that tremendously exciting. And then this new thing I was talking about in biology, CRISPR, it's a way of editing genes. I think it's going to be used in such interesting ways, again, to answer questions that people couldn't even formulate 2 or 3 years ago. So I'm very excited about that, too.
Okay, now to the point in the program where we get to talk about what we really wanted to talk about, Joe.
Right. Yep.
Just RAGBRAI. You were on RAGBRAI. How many times have you been on? Once?
More? I've only been once.
Was it last year?
Not 2016, 2015.
Excellent.
Fantastic.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, there was one town we went through that had a meteor crater that they were very eager to talk about. And I think I had my picture taken in front of their stand. I thought it was fantastic. You know, it's funny because I've known about it for 40 years plus, and I've said, I got to do that someday. And then when Don Gagne and Scott Horsley and some of my other fellow correspondents here said, that, well, we did it, I thought, oh, I got to. The gauntlet was thrown down. And so I met the most amazing people, the friendliest people, the most welcoming people I've ever met in my life. And I had just a total blast.
Agreed. Any science questions pop into your head along the way? Like what's the caloric value of church pies or the usable protein in a 2-inch thick pork chop?
I do want to know how it's possible that you can ride over, you know, whatever it is, 400 miles and gain weight.
Yes.
It's one of the few times when you go off with that much exercise. You know, it's important for exercise, and you come back a few pounds heavier than when you took off. No, I think it was a nice break from science. And unfortunately, it wasn't a total break from politics, because even then the campaign buses were appearing. This is a year and a half ago now.
So you have some sympathy with us now, Joe, because we're in Iowa. We have it all the time.
Yes, I have lots of sympathy. And, you know, it's not my first trip to Iowa, RAGBRAI, and this isn't either. I have a son who enrolled in Grinnell a few years ago in Grinnell, Iowa. And I've been at various state institutions, going back to my nature days when there was a neuroscientist at Iowa called Antonio Damasio, and I remember going and interviewing him in his office. So I've been to Iowa quite a lot, but RAGBRAI was easily the most amazing experience I've ever had on a bicycle.
You did the whole route, the whole week?
I did.
Oh.
And have the pictures to prove it.
Okay, we don't doubt
river
you.
To river, as they say.
That's exactly.
That's a good name for a show. You could use that.
We should make the. It is, in fact.
Dang,
all right. Excellent. Joe, thank you for being our guest on this edition of River to River. I want to remind everyone that Joe will be in town, in the town of Iowa City, to be more specific, on Wednesday evening. He'll be speaking at 7 o'clock at Phillips Hall in Iowa City. It's free and open to the public. What a great guy. How would you not want to meet Joe Palca after spending the hour with him?
I feel the same way. And I promise you, I will seriously avoid any questions about politics. So you can ask all you like, but I will show you my ledger domain at dodging them and not being pinned down on any subject that I can get in trouble for.
All right. NPR's science correspondent, Joe Palca. Look forward to seeing you here in Iowa, Joe. Thanks for being with us this hour.
You bet. You bet. I'm really looking forward to the trip.
All right. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, Sarah McCammon, formerly of Iowa Public Radio, talks about her experiences covering the Trump campaign for NPR tomorrow on our program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.